Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we get started, I do want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, the presenting sponsor of RAISE, the event fundraising conference. OneCause invites you to join them at RAISE, being held this year in Washington, D.C. on September 14th and 15th. RAISE brings together hundreds of fundraising professionals, industry experts, and nonprofit speakers to share insights and network with others innovating in the world of fundraising. To join the community of fearless fundraisers attending RAISE and to learn more about the conference, please visit www.onecause.com/responsive50. That's www.onecause.com/responsive50. Hi, Gabe. Thank you for being my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have done a little bit of chatting before we hit the record button, and I'm delighted to have this conversation because I think we share many of the same ideas. I do want to share with our listeners that Gabe represents a CRM company that he'll tell us a little bit about in here in a minute. That actually is a product that that Logos Academy, my previous employer, actually uses today. So I understand that they enjoy the product. And so, Gabe, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about Virtuous, and then we'll have this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks so much for having me on today. I really appreciate it. So my name is Gabe. I am the founder and CEO of Virtuous Software. And so Virtuous is a CRM and marketing platform helping nonprofits build personal relationships with all their donors. I came out of the nonprofit space and have been a tech entrepreneur here for the last 12 years, but love serving in the nonprofit space.
So what does that mean? You came out of, I've known a lot of people that, Gabe, that have sort of transitioned out of nonprofit work into a corporate model where they're, say, doing technology or something. But how would you say that that's maybe different for you, that transition? Because it doesn't sound like you were fleeing the nonprofit. You sort of turned back around and certainly wanted to help make things better. Am I right?
Yeah, that's a great question. My experience may be kind of similar to other people that have spent time working at a nonprofit. I actually was a software developer in kind of the first dot-com boom of the late 90s and had this existential crisis, like I'm not making an impact in the world. And so decided the only way to do that was to go to work at a nonprofit. So I went to work at a nonprofit. This is probably late 90s or early 2000s.
Yeah.
And spent a few years in the space, but then quickly realized that my entrepreneurial innovation gene wasn't really well suited for the pace of many nonprofits and realized that I could have far more impact if I jumped out of the space and served nonprofits. So yeah, I jumped out and we began by developing just custom software for really big nonprofits. And so we did that for years. We were doing a lot of consumer facing mobile work at when nonprofits first started getting on mobile. So we did Compassion International's child sponsorship app.
Yeah.
Like those kind of, larger consumer platforms. And then realized after doing this for some time that a lot of the nonprofits that we were working with had the same set of struggles in fundraising that my nonprofit did. And so that kind of drove us to launching Virtuous a few years back. But it's been a funny path, but despite my better judgment, I haven't been able to escape the space. I guess I just have too much passion for generosity.
Yeah, good. So, Gabe, you and I agreed that we would sort of do some comparing of notes. I think we're talking about a lot of the same things. We've both begun to use this term responsive fundraising. You're writing a book about responsive fundraising. I've named my consulting group after using the same term. And I think it, I don't know. I mean, you and I haven't had a terribly meaningful conversation yet. So I think we agreed to just sort of compare notes. And is that a good place we can spend 20 minutes or so chatting today?
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Yes. Yeah, so what is responsive fundraising mean to you?
Yeah, I'll give you my definition. I know we have a lot of similarities in how we think about this, but and you probably the same as me have just kind of felt this tension of these people. It's been kind of in the water for years about people wanting to see something different and knowing that there could be something different. And so one of the shorthands that we use is responsive fundraising helps you treat all of your donors like a major donor. And by that, we mean really fundraising comes down to relationship. I mean, if you think back to the times you've given to nonprofit, it's because you probably knew somebody there or knew somebody that was affected by the cause directly. You're passionate about it. It's a very close to home. You know, you have a friend that plays in the symphony or your mom had cancer or whatever it is, it's really close. And what we realized was that most of the fundraising tactics out in the market today were more spray and pray institutional style fundraising. They weren't very donor centric. They didn't acknowledge that these people had real lives and real relationships to the organization. So we knew that with especially modern technology, that you could actually listen to donors at scale to figure out what they actually needed, that you could respond to them in real time and meaningful ways to nurture a relationship, sort of handing over control of the relationship with a donor, and then suggest the next steps for each donor that made sense for them, not made sense to you as an organization, which is honestly a little bit scary for most nonprofits in that you're sort of, you know, handing over control in a way to the pace of the donor and the passions and preferences of the donor. So that's, I guess, a long statement, but the sort of shorthand for how we think about responses. But I'd love to hear, based on what I just said, how you guys are processing through all this.
Yeah. So the two words that we're probably most processing, or I'm most thinking about as it relates to what you just sort of the phrases you used is not it. The first thing that I think that the mistake that we have made in fundraising, and it may be that, I don't use that. What is repeat that term? And I've heard it other people use spray and pray. Is that the idea?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
It's just that mass marketing approach to fundraising, right? We sort of picked up on what the mass marketing world does, and we put all those appeals out there. But I try to encourage our clients to sort of move away from the notion of major gifts and try to encourage, just like you are, the idea that. That every donor can sort of arrive at a place where there's a meaningful gift that they give. And I think that's where a lot of organizations are sort of missing the boat, is that there's not enough meaningful giving going on. Consequently, they're getting what got me in my first book, I used the term trivial. I think there's a lot of trivial gifts that are motivated by trivial decisions. These aren't extraordinary, you know, these people just aren't making, you know, the charity hasn't sort of registered in their mind sort of a meaningful place. And consequently, they're not raising the types of support that they can. And so I tend to think, as it relates to the term, our use of the term responsive, that fundraising has sort of peaked in terms of efficiency, like it's not going to get any cheaper. And we're going to now have to sort of swing to the more responsive side of the pendulum. And it's going to mean more meaningful gifts. What's your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's so funny that you say that. We've used a similar term for years. We say tipping. So we say, you know, when you're a donor and you feel like you're outside of the organization and you're not really swept away in the cause, you tip. Right. It's like what little amount of money can I give that doesn't hurt so much that kind of assuages my guilt and gives me a vague sense that I'm involved in a cause.
Right.
And that happens when you feel like you're on the outside and there's this institution that sort of does the work on your behalf, the kind of intermediary between you and the good. And it's not till you listen to donors and draw them in close and make them feel like they're actually a part that they give sacrificially and meaningfully in your language, I think. And I don't think as an industry we've done a good job at sort of getting to the root of that.
The other word I heard you use, which is probably the word that I think is sort of stretching me the most in this. I'm working on a second book myself, and it's this notion of control. I think when we want to be more responsive, we therefore have to begin to relinquish more control. And I think our fundraising processes, Gabe, have become so largely designed to maintain a sense of control, that the idea, for example, of treating every donor like a major donor just scares the jajibis out of people. Right?
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really matter. I remember when I was talking to your colleague, Noah, I don't know, a couple of months ago, and he was telling me, he was saying, you know, we're out here trying to advocate for this very similar message, but it just doesn't click in people's minds. And I said, Noah, I said, they're used to maintaining so much control of the process that it's unnatural for them to think that they're going to sort of hand off some part of the process, some part of this relationship that doesn't maintain their sense of control. I think we've got a lot of CEOs running nonprofit organizations, hiring development directors that are control freaks. To suggest that things have to be more responsive just freaks them out.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. I think
sorry.
It's great. I think there's this the sort of thought that, hey, you know, we do our November matching gift appeal because we need that money as an institution to drive something in December, and so that's what we need people to give to. And so, but it doesn't recognize at all the fact that all of these donors are completely different. They're in different stages of life. They have different engagement levels with your organization. When they originally gave, they all had very different intents. And so if you look at it from a donor's perspective, like, you know, they don't really give a rip that, you know, you have some institutional schedule or an appeal schedule. They're at all at different points with your organization. And so until you can sort of step into a donor's shoes and see it from their perspective, and allow them to go on a journey at their pace based on their engagement level, their intent, and their interest, you're going to lose people, especially in today's world when, you know, my Spotify account knows what I like, knows what I want to listen to when I want to listen to it. My, you know, the place where I buy clothes knows how to prompt me to buy the right jacket exactly the right time. Every experience I have is hyper personalized to me, and it goes at my pace. Yet a nonprofit wants to sort of control that journey for me instead of letting me navigate it on my own. And it's sort of flipped backwards for how generosity should work.
So what most excites me about a guy like you talking about, so I'm a consulting firm. I represent a consulting firm, and we're generally advising nonprofits on how to take people out to lunch and ask them for these meaningful gifts. But for you to be a CRM company, technology company, talking about this to me is a very different thing. Because I unpack that for me, because you're taking on a different posture, it seems to me, than most of the CRM companies are going to have to take when you talk about a more responsive fundraising methodology. Responsive in my mind is the opposite of highly efficient. And so you're sort of saying that some of the efficient, I guess you're saying, this is certainly what I'm saying, some of the efficiency is going to be lost in order to gain these some of these meaningful gifts. How does a CRM company get away with that?
Yes. And so it is a little bit of a trick. And so at no point do we want to sort of take away the sort of personal high touch. In fact, we want to find ways to free up time to be more personal, more high touch. And so we just know that to do this in our modern world, you need a couple of things. You need folks like you that can provide strategy and help understanding how this new world operates. And so you need that part of it. And you sort of need a playbook, like instructions for how to live in this new world. But you also have to have tools, a platform that enables it. And so you know, the reason Spotify is a good example. The reason Spotify can recommend, you know, Ryan Adams or Wilco to me is because it knows I like those bands based on my listening habit. Like the reason Amazon that knows that I should order new Nerf darts for my kids knows that that's what I like. And so it starts to approximate a personal relationship. What we find with nonprofits is, you know, your top 100 major donors are getting a high personal touch, but they just don't have the staff to really nurture in a meaningful way the next 10,000 people.
Right.
And so what a technology allows you to do in the modern world, the way that the Amazons of the world do it or the Spotify's of the world do it, is they have tools that listen to people digitally. They figure out what networks they're a part of. They figure out what they're doing in social media. And then they begin to learn and they begin to target messages based on where you are in the stage of life. And so it becomes a blend of sort of, you know, artificial intelligence and automation that begins to create a personal stream. But then it also is prompting people at the organization. So instead of a fundraising guy just completely guessing, it can prompt the fundraising guy, hey, this person probably should get a call today. They're really into this. Here's probably their giving capacity. Like, what would be meaningful to them? Why don't you give them a call and have a conversation about this? Right. And so what it does is it begins to provide the tooling. And so you can really be responsive in real time to a large number of people, not just your top 100. And you can't without technology, you can't do it, but without strategy, you can't either. Like without, you know, agencies like the consulting groups, like the stuff you're doing, nonprofits are going to be lost without the strategy, but they're also going to be not empowered to actually pull it off without a good platform as well. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. So what's your thoughts on, so you and I have a mutual friend, Otto is at Logos Academy. He's a client of yours. He used to work for me. So he's a guy who, when he was working for me, I encouraged him to get to the lunch table. And to me, that's the definition of responsive fundraising, is the point at which, and I think that's what you guys are saying, in your language when you suggest that every donor should essentially have the opportunity to be treated like a major donor, because the major donor is that place where the relationship gets sort of so far down the spectrum, if you will, that you're sitting across a lunch table. I'm talking about strategy. You're talking about technology, but how does this in your mind change the definition? Because this is a lot of what I'm trying to mess around with, when I'm doing speaking engagements and stuff. It's the job description of the person in like Otto's seat.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think there is a little bit of a distinction between sort of a major donor focused person and somebody who's trying to scale relationships to, you know, the 100,000 people that are giving $50 a month.
Yeah.
Just because you don't have the mind space or staff space. Now, I do think part of the issue with nonprofits that we've seen at this point is fundraising and communications end up being very siloed. And in my world, in B2B SaaS, we've started to use the word schmarketing, which is sales and marketing set up together, right? And so in the nonprofit space, I think there should be a lot more of that, like, you know, fundraising and communications, or, you know, whatever the shoved together term is of fundraising and communications, because I think the more you can merge these two worlds, the better. So, you know, a guy like Otto is probably never going to have lunch with somebody giving $50 a month, that he just doesn't have the bandwidth. But what he can do is begin to use technology as one tool to be able to identify, you know, who are the 10 people that live in this neighborhood that are the best people to have lunch with? Do any of them know one another? Do any of them have capacity to give that's not financial? Like, are they social influencers? What do they care about? Do they have stuff in common? Can I ask one of them to host something for me and invite 10 of their friends? And so technology can help equip Otto, so then he's having more lunches that are more meaningful with the right people, and then equipping those people to go tell the story of the cause to their friends. And so from Otto's point of view, he's using technology in a really meaningful way to be able to have, you know, the most productive lunches that he can and build deeper relationships faster. Now, on the communication side, they know the communications person can't have lunch with 100,000 people. But then the issue becomes, how do you use technology to begin to approximate those personal connections to at least put the donor in control and make the communications more centric based on what they care about? And so that even if they don't end up ever having lunch with Otto, it's kind of like the relationship we have to, you know, Apple's a great brand for this. We kind of feel part of this broader community because the brand has sucked us in such a meaningful way. Like, how do we create that for everyday donors that may never get a lunch with Otto?
So I came across this term probably in some of the same places you guys did, but this one of my colleagues said that they thought I was getting into the responsive web design web pages sort of thing. I said, no, that's not the use of the term. I'm sure you guys have run into that too.
Yeah.
But it's this idea of, because what I do think Otto picked up on while he was working with me is this idea that there's an unpredictable sort of component to fundraising. And so while I think we were diligent while we were working together, and I suspect he continues to be this diligent, certainly with the help of your product, is this idea that there's an unpredictable aspect of what it means to be a fundraiser, and that we have to go about our work rather to exploit like a machine, we have to explore like an explorer. Like, there's an uncertainty about that. And so I think there are, in some cases, some instances where that $50 donor might be taken out to lunch just to develop that intuitiveness that I want the fundraiser to have, that says sometimes you don't know the answer and you're not. And I think that's what I mean when I say we've sort of swung the pendulum between efficiency and responsiveness, is that efficiency has sort of given us this predictability that we've all become very accustomed to. And we just don't know how to go about our work like an explorer, like with this uncertainty that, hey, maybe this won't work. Does that make sense?
Yes. Oh gosh. Yeah. And Noah from our team he always uses the word curiosity.
Yeah.
And so I think we should be, the thing I always say is I've repeated it so many times, people probably heard it and are sick of it, but my grandma used to tell me God gave us two ears and one mouth for a reason. And so, you know, I think as nonprofits, we have to be like relentless in our listening, and which means meeting with small donors, meeting with people that aren't yet donors, showing up at places where people are having a conversation about your cause and not pushing your cause, just being quiet for a minute and listening to figure out what people's intent is, what they care about. And so, you know, I think at the very heart, that is going to be what accelerates funding. We have an organization that we work with where every person on their staff, no matter if you're in program, if you're in operations, doesn't matter, you have to call donors on a monthly basis and not ask them for gifts. Just say thank you and figure out like what makes them tick and get to know them. And what they found is like that has brought, it's inspired a crazy amount of generosity, but brought the organization very, very close to their donors in meaningful ways because they're curious. They actually want to learn who people are and what makes them tick. And I think without that, you're always going to be sort of, there's going to be a wall between you and generosity that's going to be impossible to break through.
So I have to imagine, because I know that I think I've talked a little bit to Noah about this. I know the space that you guys have sort of come from. I think we both come from, we've both been influenced by our involvement with the church and with faith-based organizations. Is there a certain subversiveness to what we're both trying to talk about here?
I think it certainly comes across as subversive.
Yeah. Okay. Cause in my first book, and I've told people this up front, you know, as a Christian faith, I have been unashamedly since the first book came out. I said, look, there's a gospel message in there and you're just going to have to like it, you know, whether you like it or not. And I'm not going to make it explicit, only like on the record here, but it's in there. And I think that's part of what we're talking about with responsive too, is that some of the joy, for example, that Paul would have talked about in the in Corinthians is essentially what we're trying to create for our donors, but it's also some of the joy that I think we're trying to create for fundraisers as well on the receiving side.
Yes. I think like I think the funny thing about biblical generosity is it sort of is transcendent and sort of works across the board with all generosity. And in some ways it's intuitive. One of the big things that you see sort of in biblical generosity is there's no us versus them. There's no, I'm better than you. Like the person I'm giving to isn't a victim and I'm not a savior. We're all in this together. And then there's a joy in being able to serve others in meaningful ways through generosity, because we're all in this together. And I think that, and I think that's key to responsive, right? And so I think there's so much of that that carries over in really real ways. And I think you're right, because of the mess we've got ourselves in, it's a mess, it's not that bad. But over the last 50 years with this more mechanical, like I say, spray and pray marketing, we sort of lost sight of, you know, these are just people. Like our donors are just people that need to be served. The people getting our help, we're not saviors. They're not victims. We're all in this together. And then there's a joy that comes from serving each other and putting yourself under somebody else in a meaningful way. And I think that's, it sounds subversive, but it really shouldn't. I mean, that's sort of the very heart of generosity.
So some people would suggest, I get into these bantering conversations on social media and stuff. I'm sure you do as well. And I'm sure members of your team might occasionally as well at conferences and such. But how do we differentiate the idea of being responsive to our donors from the idea of sort of letting them take advantage of us?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it comes up a lot with especially major donors who want to have a bunch of stuff tied to the gift. Right. You know, and they want it to do what it's going to do. But I think the funny thing about relationship, where if you actually listen and build a relationship with people, what comes out of that is trust. And so a lot of times when donors start dictating things, it's because they may not trust you and they may not believe you. And so they want to try to finagle their own thing out of it.
Yeah.
But what happens once you build a relationship is I think people learn to trust you. When you listen, what you find is, you know, sit and listen to a major donor for an hour, their concerns, acknowledge their concerns, have a great back and forth, real conversation. At the end of it, what you'll find is because that donor now trusts you, they're more willing to let go of their resources and say, you know, I trust you. Go do the work that you're going to do with this money. And they do it on their own time and their own way. But I think the thing people fear is actually the opposite, because they've lost trust in institutions. And so now they want to try to control it, but it doesn't have to be that way. And if you can build trust, and the other thing that comes out of it too, is sometimes donors are right. I mean, the funny thing is sometimes the major donor says, I think this is like maybe not the best thing. And sometimes, you know, as a nonprofit, you hate to hear that, but it's a good exercise to listen, and maybe you learn something and can do something better next time. So that's a scary thing, but I don't think it's a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we've been, again, I have been, I'm not a researcher. I'm a fundraiser. I spent 25 years raising money and I'm learning how to become a researcher. And I've been sort of digging into these ideas that we're talking about and sort of where they originate. And I shared with you earlier before we hit the record button, this idea that a lot of this originated during the Enlightenment when we were sort of trying to flee the relationship with the church and the superstition and sort of the mystery and the organic sort of way that life worked prior to Newton and Descartes and all these guys who tried to turn everything into very numerical, precise, certain, very predictable sort of ways of thinking, you know, math, you know, math and science and technology sort of came on the scene. And it just makes me think that now fundraising is sort of the last profession that is sort of having to wrestle with that at a time when I think more of these responsive like conversations are coming on the scene. And so I think we're going to have to kind of we're going to have to like sort of choose a side, because we're either going to have to remain on that efficiency side where efficiency is sort of our primary metric, or we're going to build these more meaningful relationships and consequently actually be able to change the world. I sort of bring this back to you guys being a CRM company. I think it's very admirable that you're sort of out there. Is anybody else in your space, your CRM space, the technology world, sort of talking like this?
No. In fact, we have a couple of the other people kind of throwing rocks at the way we're talking right now. I think there's a lot of kind of blowback, honestly, which is funny. I mean, some of the other companies out there are great, but they're great at doing the existing thing, right? Yeah. So how do we kind of blast out our monthly appeals? How do we store our donor data, right? It's kind of the traditional approach. Yeah. And it's not that it's bad software. It's great software in some cases. And I just think the reality, though, is if you really want to move the needle on generosity, like doing more of the same, and the numbers prove this out, it's giving USA data or whatever you want to look at, but the numbers prove it out. Just banging the gong harder that we've been banging for the last 40 years is not producing more results. And so, we have to think differently about this. And unless your software is lined up with that new way of thinking, you're always going to be fighting against your software. And so that's what we're trying to prevent.
Yeah. So I have had your attention for more than a half hour. Usually we begin to lose our listeners at about this point. It sounds like we're pretty in sync, and it sounds like we can continue to have conversations and really sync up even more. I definitely think Gabe, you and I can contribute to one another's thinking, but there might be people out there who want to contribute to yours and they don't know how to find you. How would you suggest that they do that?
Yeah, that's great. So you can check us out at virtuouscrm.com. If you want to learn more about some of these ideas from our perspective, we do have like a responsive playbook that you can download on that site if you click on what is responsive. And then we also have a new book coming out called Responsive Fundraising. We get hardback copies this month, so look for that anywhere fine books are sold. But we'd love to learn more. And yeah, man, I appreciate the conversation today. It's always encouraging to chat with other people that are thinking the same way we are. So thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, it's been great. You're always welcome back, Gabe. Noah has been on the podcast, and anybody else on your team is certainly welcome. I just get the pleasure of hosting the party, if you might. It's certainly been a pleasure. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.